Parents standing in a driveway waving goodbye as their adult children drive off. It's a scene that's both moving and mundane when you're in a position to take it for granted. But in a photo series by Kansas City artist Deanna Dykeman, who captured these scenes with her own parents over the years, the mundane melts away and you're just left with the beauty and poignance of a simple gesture repeated again and again until it stops. I'm Gina Kaufman. This is KCUR's Central Standard. And I'm joined by Deanna Dykeman. Her series, Leaving and Waving, just got some major love from the photo booth column in The New Yorker. Deanna, good morning.
Good morning.
Congratulations on that piece in The New Yorker. That's a really big deal.
It was. Thank you. I'm just overwhelmed.
Tell me about the very first photo in this series. Like, take me back with you to the moment when you took that picture.
You know, it was just a snapshot. I wasn't trying to do anything. I hadn't started any project. I was leaving. I was the passenger seat of the car, and Mom came all the way to the curb to wave. And my dad was kind of hanging in the background, and they always hated to see me go. And it was just so sweet, and I had my camera ready somehow. And snap, there was the first picture.
Can you, this whole series, you know, begins with both of your parents, and then it moves to just your mom, and then, you know, that part of the series ends too, and it is a journey through your relationship with your aging parents. That must have been a really hard thing to see so concretely laid out in front of you while it was happening.
I didn't see it for a while. It wasn't laid out in front of me because it was just part of all the pictures I was taking of them. But yes, at some point when I saw what I had done and I knew I was going to keep going, it was hard sometimes.
Tell me about your parents, just who they are, who they were, and what your relationship with them has been like over the years.
I was incredibly lucky to have great parents who just loved me dearly. And after I went away to college, I never really lived near them. My life has always taken me elsewhere, but I always wanted to visit, and they always wanted me there. And every time I visited, it was hard to leave. My mom grew up in Sioux City, Iowa. My dad grew up on a farm in Nebraska. They've lived there their whole lives. I have a lot of extended family there.
And, you know, when these photographs, they are sort of... like, you see them very close together in some of the photographs, but even when they're far apart, they look like they're kind of moving in unison. Can you tell me about their relationship?
Oh, they were very much entwined, yes. I mean, you know, like anybody, they don't always agree with things. But, you know, when Dad was gone, Mom was just, you know, half of her was missing.
Do you have a favorite photo in this series?
Well, I kind of like the one where they're looking at my little dog. That's always been one of my favorites.
I like that one, too. Can you tell me about that photo and try to put your finger for us on what you like about it?
Well, they're just looking, you know, into the car at my little dog. And later on, they would have views into the car. And I don't think they were waving to me. They were waving to my son. So quite often, it wasn't a goodbye to me in the car. It was a goodbye to someone or some pet. Instead.
Well, you know, I would really like to hear a little bit more about the span of this adventure, because it's a 27-year chronicle of your parents saying goodbye, right?
Right.
27 years. That's a long time. You see, you know, not just the loss of one and then both parents, but along the way you see their faces change. You see a lot of things change.
Oh, their posture becomes a little more bent over. A cane starts appearing on my dad's hand to hold him up. There's one picture, and I didn't even see it. I didn't see it for many years, actually, where my dad and my mom, one of them's holding the other up a little bit. I think my mom has a grip on my dad's arm, if I remember correctly. And I just saw that within the past month or two. And I thought, wow, there's so much more in these than I even know.
The pairing of the two together, when they are truly, they both have their hands up at the same time. And I understand that at first, your mom's reaction to you picking up the camera as she was waving was to say, put that thing away. It looks like they have embraced their role as goodbye models.
Well, yes, they have. And once they knew what I was doing, and I made a little trial book right before my dad died, and he saw that. And they were very generous with letting me show them to the world. And, you know, I always appreciate that because they knew what I was doing at some point.
What is it that standing and waving goodbye means to you? I mean, what does that represent in a relationship or just, yeah, mostly in a relationship?
Well, they were getting older. And, you know, like I said, I didn't live there full time. The visits were special. And every time I left, I never knew if I would see one or both of them again. We never know what's going to happen in our lives. And I guess since I'm a photographer, I always felt like if I just have one last picture, I've got a little bit of them inside my camera when I drive away.
It says so much about how people do relate to parents and grandparents as they get older. Can you talk a little bit about, because these are people you've had a relationship with from when you were tiny, from the very beginning of your life, but this is a part of that relationship that a lot of people talk about through the lens of a struggle or the challenges. But what you feel in these photos is just the immense love. And that piece of it doesn't get talked about a lot. The particular kind of love you have for your parents as you are getting older. And they are.
Well, I think that's universal. And it's coming to me in clear messages. Because ever since the New Yorker ran this, I've been getting emails and Facebook messages and Instagram posts from all these people, and they tell me they're touched, and then they tell me about their own parents and their own grandparents and how they left or honked the horn or came out to the curb or kicked the tires on the car. It's universal.
Yeah, I mean, it doesn't have the taken-for-grantedness of a child's relationship with their parents. It captures the fact that you can't take it for granted. It's a 27-year goodbye.
That's right. And I think the message that I'm getting from some of these people is, wow, I've been doing this and I didn't really know what I was doing. And I'm so happy to see your photos because it reminds me of what I have.
Do you have a favorite memory of your mom? And I'm going to ask you the same thing about your dad, that these photographs really keep alive for you?
Wow. I guess she would always tear up. What the photos usually don't show is the tears in her eyes. And those might have been when I gave her the hug and the kiss before I got in the car and got out the camera. So there was always probably a couple tears there before the picture was taken.
And what about your dad?
My dad, he's kind of the reason I think I took up a camera. So he understood and he was always cool with my taking a picture. And he knew and he didn't worry about the camera. So he was always sweet and patient. And whenever I took a picture of him, he didn't mind. And that's what I remember.
Can you tell me about your son, who is a little person in a car seat for many of these photos, but how old he is now and how many years he got to spend having relationships with his grandparents?
Well, he's 22 years old now. So he was in most of that series. He shows up in 1997. And he was in the very last picture I took of my mom before she died.
This captures something that I think must be really special for him, too, because as he gets older and, you know, you get a certain number of years with your own parents and then your child gets fewer than that with them, that he gets to have that sort of chronicled, that he was just a passenger, but he is there and that's his relationship with them, too.
Oh, yes. And he was a very special, he had a very special relationship. He was the only grandchild. It was all heaped on him, all that love.
I can hear in your voice how hard this is, and we're going to let you go pretty soon. But I do just want to ask you, you know, I think that this must be both hard to look at and such a wonderful thing to look at. In the balance, what does it feel like to you? Are you glad to have these photos now? I'm just thinking about those of us who might be like, maybe I should start taking pictures.
Oh, yes. I mean, these are treasures for me. Sometimes I just working on them and they're my pictures. And then once in a while, and I'm on the computer and I look at the screen and my dad's eyes are kind of looking straight at me and I think, wow, there he is. And I'm just so pleased I have them.
Deanna Dykeman, thank you so much.
You're welcome. My pleasure.
You can check out this Kansas City photographer series, Leaving and Waving, in The New Yorker online. That's newyorker.com. I'm Gina Kaufman. When we return, we're going on a trip without Clorox wipes. And don't worry, it's a literary adventure. Our bibliophiles will recommend great books about travel to satisfy wanderlust if you're staying home this spring break. We'll be right back. We're back. I'm Gina Kaufman. This is KCUR's Central Standard, and now we're living in super crazy times, and maybe you've got some voting to do, but when the day is done, all the voting stickers have been procured, offices left behind, dinners eaten, dishes done, we want to help you get away from it all with books that take you far, far away. Books about travel and adventure. The bibliophiles are here with some of their favorites to recommend, and you can call 816-235-2888 if you have a great one that the rest of our listeners need to know about. 816-235-2888. You can also tweet those recommendations at KCURCST. Katie Stover, Jeffrey Ann Gowdy, Mark Luce, hello.
Good morning.
Hi. Nice to be here.
So where are we going on our trips today? Just shout out the destinations.
Seriously, where are we going?
Yeah.
Hong
coronavirus?
Kong.
Amazon jungle, China, Pacific Crest Trail.
El Dorado.
The time after the apocalypse.
We're going there, too.
So I want to acknowledge before we dive in that when we picked travel books as our theme, we envisioned some listeners maybe getting ready for big trips over spring break. And I am sure some people still are. But, of course, we had not anticipated the current anxiety about travel. Has that influenced the books you selected in any way?
Influenced mine. I looked at day trips. So I have a book, Day Trips from Concerning Missouri, one from Kansas. I brought Atlas Obscura. I brought Greetings from the Lincoln Highway.
Accessible travel
yes.
for those who aren't eager to get on an airplane.
I brought accessible, familiar, interesting travel books for folks who know they're not leaving their armchair anytime soon.
Who else was influenced by this?
I brought Travel Under Pressure. Because we all feel a lot of anxiety right now. So no cheerful little, you know, books about travel, but
okay,
travel with angst.
I thought in terms of metaphorical journeys. So there's the travels that aren't there. I think there's one of my books is
Life is a Journey.
Nonfiction. And the rest are fictional travels.
All right. Well, Katie, you see there being three types of travel books.
Yes, they seem to fall into three different types. Memoir and personal accounts, think Wild or Eat, Pray, Love or anything by Bill Bryson. History, Land, and Place, and this is where you get those general fedores, mobile guides, the what to see, where to do.
Yeah, digging deep.
Digging deep. But that's also where you find offbeat guides like Atlas Obscura and those 1001 Before You Die series. And then there are books, the other category is journeys, escapes, and adventures. And that's a really good place to put, I brought The Odyssey with me and Into Thin Air by John Krakauer. I bought The Odyssey for Mark.
You know, what do you guys think travel books do well at their best from a literary standpoint and not just the whole I want to go to there thing?
For nonfiction travel writing, like what do they do well in a literary sense?
Yeah.
I think that your best travel writers give you a sense of place and carry with them a voice of authenticity. I think bad travel writing is fairly easy to spot because it's like I'm here gawking at this thing and I don't fit in. And they might not realize it, but as a reader, you realize it fairly quickly.
You know
right?
what?
Or I spent 5 minutes here, but I'm telling you way more about it that I picked up from somebody else.
There's a level of immersion, I think, in really great travel writing that produces authenticity.
You know, in storytelling series, I coach people who are not professional writers necessarily in how to tell a story. And travel themes are great because there is a built-in beginning, middle, and end. Whereas, like, most nonfiction, you have to kind of isolate, like, where does this story begin and what has changed? And that just there is a built-in framework that means you actually – that it has to go somewhere. It has to.
And not only that, it's the character that starts, the person who's telling the travel story – knows there's going to be a change. So as readers, we get to follow that change. And we know that that's why they're going. Travel writing also, it's about tone, capturing the tone of a place and exploring all these different characters. It's about the internal change of the narrator. And there are so many different elements of books that people love that travel writing encompasses. It's character, it's pacing, yeah. It's tone.
I think that... one of the things that I don't particularly like in travel writing is actually I don't like in any nonfiction writing or storytelling is the and then this happened and then this happened
right.
and then
oh.
this happened. And so I think oftentimes, you know, especially sort of you're talking about teaching people kind of how to write, and I do the same thing mm-hmm. with nonfiction. It's like they want to sit at the barstool and tell you a story about, hey, I went to this place, and they just go and then and then and then and then. Instead of thinking about, okay, so what did this mean? Like, what did
What's
this travel? Yeah, what is the subject? Like,
yeah.
What is this story about? And if the travel writer just says, oh, I'm going to visit these restaurants and I'm going to go see these museums, it's sort of like, okay, and?
Yeah. I was talking to Mark before we got on about Rolf Potts, who's a travel writer who's based in Kansas.
We've interviewed him a few times.
Yeah.
And
the one essay I read by him, he actually set up this conceit where he tries to infiltrate a movie set on a Leonardo DiCaprio movie to sort of just have something be really different. I mean, like, I'm not a tourist here, right? I have a sense of danger. I'm infiltrating this movie set on the Phi Phi Islands off Thailand.
Let's go to a caller. Kristen's calling us from Overland Park to recommend a book, and then we'll dive into our critics' recommendations. Kristen in Overland Park, good morning.
Hi, good morning.
What do you want to recommend and why?
So I just finished The Soul of an Octopus, which is kind of a travel book. It is nonfiction. It's about a naturalist, and she basically becomes friends with the deep sea curator at the New England Aquarium, and it just talks about how her experience meeting the different octopuses that they have there and the stages of their lives, and she's traveling because she's a naturalist, so of course she's traveling, but it talks about how she becomes scuba certified so that she can do, like, she goes to Tahiti to look for, you know, certain kinds of warm water octopuses. And then, I mean, it's just very interesting, and it just totally changed the way that I view not only octopuses, because I don't really know that much about them, but just animals in general. She did a very interesting TED talk that I heard after I read the book about the emotions of animals and how for a long time humans viewed the emotions of animals to be less
yeah.
than humans, and that's how we kind of were better. And I think anybody who has a pet, you know, can say, well, my pet loves me, you know.
Yeah.
Cats.
Kristen,
I
really appreciate this call. Thank you so much. That's a recommendation for The Soul of an Octopus. And that's a very specific kind of travel literature where there's this lens. And in this case, it's the lens of octopus study. but it could be anything. Like, it's the difference between traveling just to look around and traveling with a purpose. Anyone? On this general topic?
Most people like to travel with a purpose. That's what people like about travel writing, is they want to know what the traveler's purpose was.
Quest.
It is. It's a very personal quest. That's another reason why readers like to read travelogues. And they're a coming of age of sorts, and it doesn't matter how old you are. So I actually prefer the travel writing of folks who skew a little older in publishing, like 40s, 50s, 60s. You've led your life up to this point, and now and now what? And so you go traveling. And what I love about travelogues that feature older characters is that they have so much life experience and sometimes battered by life. And they're going to take all that and drop it into their journeys and then distill it into this new place, this new home for some of them, and give it back to us and make us think about where we are with our lives and where we want to go and what we want to do.
Let's dive in with critics' recommendations. Mark, a longtime classic, Around the World in 80 Days.
You know, this is Jules Verne, and it was published in 1873. And the basic part of it is Fogg says it's easy to get around the world. The people at his reform club say, no, it's not. They bet £20,000 on it. And so off he goes with his new valet, Passepartout. And they one of the things that's so cool about this book, it's an adventure book. But it is sort of the seeds of global trade. What you see is a world that is changing and that is shrinking. It's got, obviously it has colonialism in it quite a bit, but it also has sort of mechanization, and, they travel in all these kind of different ways by all these different, types of, transportation. And there's even a cross-cultural romance, which would be basically unheard of at the time, sort of in literature and sort of celebrated. Even though Aouda, who is technically Indian, is described as sort of white, there still is this sort of cross-cultural romance. And you literally go around the world with these guys. And it also has a detective element to it. So it's just it's a fun book, and if you look at it with a lens of trade and technology and race, it becomes even more interesting than just a fun story about a rich guy going around the world.
So that's Around the World in 80 Days by Jules Verne. Jeff, you brought in Wild by Cheryl Strayed, which was made into a movie a while back starring Reese Witherspoon. I love Cheryl Strayed.
Yeah, I love Cheryl Strayed, too, and the book is so much better than the movie, I think. But this is in terms of an interior journey and an exterior journey. Cheryl Strayed was published this, and it recounted an experience that she had when it was actually 17 years before the book was published, and she had her mother died of a fast-moving cancer when she was 22, and she just hit rock bottom. She started cheating on her husband. She started dabbling in heroin, if you could be said to dabble in heroin. She hit absolutely rock bottom. She decided to redeem herself by going on this trek on the Pacific Crest Trail. She started in the Mojave Desert, and she ended up in the Oregon-Washington border. She lost 4 toenails. She lost a shoe. She lost weight, but she gained her self-respect. But Cheryl Strayed has a voice, an incredible voice. She has what writers want. And
it's musical. Like, as you read it, you just can sort of immerse yourself in the flow of what she's writing, which is really...
Well, and she also has an incredible emotional clarity and presence that really comes through. When I was reading this book, I wanted to be Cheryl Strayed. I wanted to be the kind of person who would take a 1,100-mile, 3-month solo trek. But I'm not that kind of person, but I can read about it. So
she was real. That's what I liked about that book. That's what I liked about Wild.
She's not, like, always heroic. She's sometimes... often really struggling.
Right. And when I compare that book to Eat, Pray, Love, I connect more with Cheryl Strayed in Wild than I do with Elizabeth Gilbert in Eat, Pray, Love.
Okay, I want to throw out here that Michelle Tyrene Johnson, who is our race, culture, and identity reporter at KCUR, she has recommended Eat, Pray, Love. And so I'm going to throw that out there as one of our staff recommendations, because now we are talking about this difference between these two books. Katie?
It's far more emotional in Eat, Pray, Love. And I liked the first two segments better. The first segment of Eat, Pray, Love, Eat, where she's living in Italy and struggling with her first personal trauma, that seemed to be more of what connected to Wild. That's where I would draw the comparisons. But I also felt with Eat, Pray, Love that it was too easy for that for Elizabeth Gilbert to walk away and just go travel to heal. It felt a lot harder for Cheryl Strayed to do that in Wild. And so while I enjoyed both books, I enjoyed the emotion in Wild far more than I did in Eat, Pray, Love, because it just seemed as if, well, my life is falling apart. I'm just going to go to Italy and learn how to speak Italian. And I was like, that's just, no one's living that kind of life. So
if you are, though, good for you.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. I say I wanted to live that kind of life, but it was very hard for me to connect with the author of Eat, Pray, Love. I had far less trouble connecting with Cheryl Strayed while reading Wild.
Well, it's a story of reinvention and redemption. People often travel and make pilgrimages to regain themselves, and she did regain her self-respect. She did something very, very hard, and she regained her self-respect through it. And she had really, really hit rock bottom.
Well, so that is a recommendation for Cheryl Strayed's Eat, Pray, Love, as well as a staff recommendation, Cheryl Strayed's Wild, as well as a staff recommendation for Eat, Pray, Love by Elizabeth Gilbert. Katie, the best women's travel writing of 2006 is on your list. What was so great about this anthology from that particular year?
Well, this one's an older, this is part of a series, the best women's travel writing. It does go up to 2018, and I looked for that one, but this is the one that was on the shelf. And what I like about these stories is that they're inspiring and they're uplifting. It's a great mix of female voices. Some of them, Maya Angelou in Italy is in here. Anne Lamott in the Caribbean, writing about being on a cruise ship. This book I picked up really quickly to promote to readers who want a nice mix of visiting different places with different female voices, different perspectives, and it's a pick-up, put-down kind of travel book. This is one you could pack away with you and take with you. But it's the fresh perspectives and the lively storytelling that I appreciated about this one when I grabbed it. And I wanted to bring a collection of essays.
Why? Can I just ask what? So as long as we've just heard about a couple of books by women where being a woman traveling alone, it seems to be really a crucial aspect of the journey. And then you've got this anthology of women's travel writing. What is it about that voice that is particular?
I think it's because women traveling alone face a higher level of anxiety and danger that men traveling alone don't. And I've talked to my male friends about traveling alone, and they just don't seem to think about the same things that women think about. And I've traveled alone in Europe just a couple of years ago, and there are things that you wonder about, that everything when you're a woman traveling alone, everything is an adventure. Everything is heightened. Getting into a cab to the airport is an adventure. Walking outside of your Airbnb or your hotel and holding up a map is an adventure, because you never know who's going to notice you, even though you hope that in some cases you're invisible. And you never know what is around every corner. Now, in the same token, because sometimes as a woman traveling alone, you can be invisible, you get to stand unnoticed in front of some pretty incredible things and move through public squares and situations, and no one's paying attention to you, and you can be paying attention to everything.
You know, it's interesting. So I think that what you're talking about can apply from a gender perspective. I think that there are implications in what you're saying from a race perspective, too. And I want to share another staff recommendation, because I did ask KCUR staffers for their favorite examples of travel writing. Genevieve Desmarteau recommends a travel blog by one of her classmates from college. It's called The Blog Abroad. And the writer, Gloria Atanmo, has a book called Excuses to Excursions, How I Started Traveling the World. And the themes she frequently explores include, according to Genevieve, traveling as a Black woman, creating a seven-figure career that began with about $10, not having her Nigerian parents support her travel writing and blogging because they wished she would instead marry a doctor, settle down, and pursue a traditional job that they could understand, and being a tourist who is respectful of the culture you're visiting. So that's a blog, The Blog Abroad, and a book, From Excuses to Excursions, How I Started Traveling the World. I'm going to just also real quick share another KCUR staff pick, Underland by Robert McFarlane. That's recommended by Mike Russo. He's our head of marketing. And I'm just going to read what Mike says, okay, you guys? He says, OMG, this book. It's about all things underground, caves, underground urban explorers, underground river travelers, and more so it's about the people who do these things and how they're affected by, quote, deep time. I am still quoting Mike when I say this book is a must read for anyone wondering if they are living life correctly. The answer is slow down and look beneath the surface, ya numbnut.
That's good. I'm familiar with that book. It's on my TBR pile. I love offbeat travel like that.
So you have actually a lot of off, what I would call offbeat travel on your list, but tell us about Atlas Obscura by Jonathan Ford, Dylan Thuris, and Ella Morton.
Oh, well, this is a great book, which is just a collection of all the unusual places in the world that you can go. This book does cover the world. I did earmark or dog ear Missouri, and yes, Layla's Hair Museum is in here, but so is Subtropolis. So, Mike, maybe you should go engage in the underground, the Groundhog Run every January. And of course, it's got on the other page I marked in where is it? In Minneapolis is the world's quietest room. It's so well soundproof that there's no echo. And apparently when you walk into that room, you can hear your own heartbeat. You can hear the flow of your breath. You can hear the gurgling of your digestive system. And according to the folks that work at the world's quietest room, most folks can last only a couple of minutes. And as soon as the owner turns out the lights, they can't last at all. Half an hour is unimaginable. I also went to the different places where I had been. So I've been to Iceland recently, and the things that are marked in Iceland are the Icelandic Elf School. And yes, anybody who's been to Reykjavik, there is the Icelandic Phallological Museum is listed in here. Yes, Jeff, it's that. And if anyone's been there, then you know that it's mostly animal parts, not human parts. There are no human parts in this museum.
There are a lot of unexpected destinations in Atlas Obscura.
Yes.
And then, Mark, you have what I consider to be one of the most public radio spins on travel literature that I could imagine, The Road by Cormac McCarthy.
Yeah, so... the most public radio or least public radio?
I mean, I don't
know.
I think most.
It's like my hot take on yeah. travel literature.
Yeah. I don't mean that as an insult.
So
I am in public radio.
The man and the boy in the road are in a post-apocalyptic landscape. We're unsure. The book's written by Cormac McCarthy. We're unsure of what exactly happened, but we do know that the mom is no longer with them, and so the man and the boy decide that they need to get to the coast. This is fiction. If you sort of map it by the clues, basically they're going from the mountains of Tennessee and their goal is to get to the shore, basically of South Carolina. And so they take highways and sort of state highways and county roads and trying to make their way through a landscape that is. Dangerous would be kind of an understatement. There's cannibals. There's sort of just wandering people. People are reduced to their sort of lowest point, and they do whatever they can to survive. It's a crushingly sad story, but it's also a testament to the boy's love for his father and the father's love for his son. And it is a beautiful book, but it is a haunting and terrifying book. But I think that the journey that they make is not dissimilar to the type of journey that Dante would make or that Ulysses would make. And their mode of transportation is foot and a cart.
You can call with your recommendations for travel literature, but do it fast. 816-235-2888 is the number to call. I'm Gina Kaufman. This is KCUR Central Standard with the Bibliophiles. Back in a sec. We're back. I'm Gina Kaufman. This is KCUR's Central Standard, and I'm here with the bibliophiles, Katie Stover. Hi, Katie.
Hello.
Jeffrey Ann Gowdy, hello to you.
Hello.
And Mark Luce. Hi, Mark.
Hi.
Okay, so we are talking travel books, and Jeff, we just heard about a novel, and let's stick with novels for a little longer. The Leavers is by Lisa Coe, and it's Travel Under Extreme Pressure, which was your sort of guiding light this session.
Absolutely. This is just an incredibly well-written book. It was published in 2017 and got Barbara Kingsolver's Bellwether Prize for Socially Engaged Fiction. It's actually the last book review I did for the Kansas City Star when they were still publishing book reviews. So, and I think it was also a book, a KC Star book.
Yes, it was an FYI book.
Yeah. And it has a very engaging character named Polly, who's an undocumented Chinese immigrant who is working at a nail salon, and she's living in a cramped Bronx apartment with her son and her boyfriend's sister. And she tells her son, before I had you, I was going to travel the world, but now you're my home. She also tells him that she wants to work in Florida. And one day she doesn't come home from work. He thinks she's working late. In fact, she's been arrested at her nail salon, and she spent time at a detention center and been deported back to China. He is adopted by an academic couple. He transforms from Deming to Daniel. Turns out that Polly had been Pelion when she was originally in China. She reinvents herself.
Jeff, I'm starting to get worried that we're going to give away.
Oh, dear. Okay. Anyway, they reunite. They're separated. And they reunite in China. It's about travel under pressure, about leaving, being forced to leave, about returning,
about
finding home. So it loosely fits in travel. It's travel under extreme pressure.
And this is how people sometimes do move through the world and go from place to place. It's not always by choice, and it's not always for fun.
Exactly. It's often by force. Especially, it's a very topical novel.
So that's The Leavers by Lisa Coe?
Yes.
And then you also brought in State of Wonder, which is a novel by Ann Pritchett.
Ann Patchett. Yeah. And it's set in both icy Minnesota and in the Amazon jungle. And Patchett is such a brilliant writer. But in this book, it kind of sags a little bit, but the ending is absolutely brilliant and very Ann Patchettian. But I'll just briefly give a nugget little review here. It's about a woman who's a researcher and goes into the jungle to find out what happened to her lab partner. And he's supposedly has died of a mysterious fever. And I won't give too much away about what happens there. But in the jungle, she confronts herself, some truths about herself, and learns to forgive herself. And the doctor, she works for a pharmaceutical company. The doctor she goes to check on is researching a tribe where the women stay fertile into their 60s and 70s. Anyways, it's an elegantly written book, especially at the end. I love Ann Patchett. So it's sort of a little bit of a take on Heart of Darkness, only not horror, but fecundity at the heart of it.
Okay, cool. So that is another novel, and it is called State of Wonder by Ann Patchett, and it's the Travel as Quest category.
That's right.
Let's, Katie, you brought in The Odyssey.
I did.
Talk to me about that. That's, it's been around a while.
I brought that one in quickly, just because I thought, for fun, this is a travel book. It falls into the...
It is, though. It gets back at that idea that you aren't always just like, where do I want to go this spring break?
Right. And it fits the definition you gave, which is it has a beginning, middle, and end. And the element that I noticed that the journeyer had a quest and he had a purpose. But I brought...
Okay, so like imagining... I think it is not safe to assume that everyone has read The Odyssey. So talk to us about it like you don't know what this book is about.
And Mark can jump in, too, because I know he's taught it a bazillion times. It's about Captain Odysseus, who leaves to go fight the Trojan War. And on the way back from the Trojan War, essentially his ship gets blown off course. And he has all these adventures before he can get back home. It's a 20-year time span, right, Mark?
Yep.
And while he's gone... For Penelope at home is doing her best to keep away.
His wife.
Yes, Penelope, his wife, is doing her best to keep all the suitors at bay who think that right now she is a very wealthy widow. But along the way, Odysseus runs into a lot of shape-shifting adversaries. Calypso, Circe, the Sirens, the Cyclops, and he's just...
Scylla and Charybdis.
Scylla and Charybdis, right. They're my favorites.
And those are the ones who slurp up the ocean, right?
Yeah, there's two different, yeah. It's like whirlpools and a giant. It's not a pleasant scene.
So Captain Odysseus is doing okay on this journey. His crewmen, not so much, and they're pinballing between islands of adversity.
Although he seems when he's with Circe, like he's there for a while. He's there a little bit longer than he probably needs to be. He's like, well, I'm going to go home. Well,
no, I mean, that's the thing about this story.
She's
kind of
hot. I'm going to stay here.
This is totally the story of, like, is he going to get back? And meanwhile, you show this woman who is waiting at home kind of, what did they keep calling her? Enduring? Was that the word?
Something, yeah.
Enduring, long-suffering, pseudo-widow.
And she keeps weaving and unweaving a tapestry because she's able to keep the suitors at bay as long as she is still working on her.
She's manipulative and clever.
Tool of mourning. Yeah. It's a pretty, like, when you see her story as the person waiting at home and his story where at every turn his return is
gallivanting.
Yeah. But also, definitely, like, at points also really longs for home and has genuine obstacles, too.
He does have genuine obstacles.
I mean, monsters.
He has monsters, yes.
And
some
long
of them
distances.
Personal.
Yeah. Okay, so that's the Odyssey.
Right.
By Homer.
But I brought in Simon Armitage's version because it was originally commissioned for BBC Radio. It's very readable. It's very accessible. It's good for students. Students, do not read this in place of the Odyssey in class. Read this as a supplement.
There's a great translation by Stan Lombardo, who's a classics professor,
yes.
I think emeritus at this point, at KU. He did the Aeneid, he did the Odyssey, and he did the Iliad.
Wow.
Yeah, he's terrific, and all of his versions are terrific in audio.
Yeah.
So an unexpected local connection to the Odyssey by Homer. Recommended as travel literature. You know, we have a lot of recommendations on Twitter. I'm going to read a couple of those. We have one that is by Catherine Ryan Hyde. The book is called Have You Seen Luis Valdez? It's the journey of a 17-year-old boy who feels he is a misfit at home and school. He befriends a cat in an abandoned building and then an elderly woman. It's sort of an I haven't heard about this book. Who knows maybe a little bit more about it? Anyone? Totally intrigued.
All I know about it is that my book groups are eating it up and it's on my list, but it keeps going out.
We also have Lee on Twitter talking about Assassination Vacation by Sarah Vowell, where she visits sites relating to assassinated presidents. Mark is groaning.
She's my favorite.
Sorry,
oh,
I couldn't
great.
Tell the difference.
She's absolutely hysterical. Both that and Partly Cloudy Patriot. She can do no wrong in my book.
Okay, so that was a sigh of admiration.
Wonderful. Oh, yes.
Okay, I'm glad to hear that.
No, not a groan. Not a groan.
Okay, so and then one more. We have Blue Highways by William Leistheat Moon. I just interviewed him a couple weeks ago about his newest book, but that is a classic. Anyone want to say some words about Blue Highways by William Leistheat Moon?
Oh, it's been years since I've read that, but I kept my copy, and it was a favorite of Henry Fortunato's at the Kansas City Public Library. And I love that book. If you're going to read that book, be prepared for a long, deep dive.
I was going to say it's a door stopper for
it
sure.
It is.
You put it in the same category as Zen and the Art of Motorcycle Maintenance?
It's
kind of like early 70s, mm-hmm. late 60s, early 70s.
Yeah.
Like
life got
exploring.
Life got crazy. I just picked up and left in a van. And by the way, so he did, it's nonfiction. He traveled the country hearing stories of Americans in places like pre-internet where you weren't hearing voices from every nook and cranny of the country, arguably still or not. But at this time, that was a very novel concept. And he left his home in a van with a recording tool of some kind. And when when I talked to him about it, he told me that the van that he rode around in is now in a museum and that he goes and visits it and sits behind the wheel sometime and that he always gets a little misty-eyed. So That really was a touching thought to me as
that
well.
That would seem to be in the same vein as like a Kerouac's On the Road. While the On the Road is technically fiction, it's really not fiction. In a book, I think the Least Heat Moon and the Piersig, these are books for younger readers, like readers in their late teens and early 20s. I think I can't imagine trying to read Kerouac at this point.
In that category, perhaps for some, is another item on your list, Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy.
Yeah, I picked this one in the... this book is now 42 years old, which I didn't realize. And if you know the book, then you'll know the significance of that number. But I wanted an intergalactic journey. And so you get this. There's a fellow named Arthur Dent who's minding his own business on the planet Earth. And this travel writer named Ford Prefect basically plucks him off the face of the planet right before the planet explodes and takes him into this rogues gallery of intergalactic weirdness with a guy named Zaphod Beeblebrox, who has two heads and three arms, and then everybody's favorite Marvin, the paranoid android, who's a basically a depressed robot who walks around and talks about how depressed he is. It's totally fun. It's the first of a series of four books, I think. And it's... even now, I mean, I read this when I was probably 16 or 17, and I taught it a few years ago, and it was an absolute sort of kick in the pants. It's just fun. And goofy and absurd, but fun.
I want to share another recommendation from Twitter, because Caroline tweets about a children's book. And I do think it's interesting. Journey and adventure is a big part of children's books, and it can be really just distill what travel writing does really well. This is one that I'm not familiar with, Walk Two Moons. Does anyone else know that?
I know the title. I kind of know it, but I don't. I think that my kids read it in sixth or seventh grade.
Does anyone else have a favorite, like, children's travel book?
Stuart Little.
Go on.
Stuart Little, the mouse who's born to human parents, which that's kind of weird, but he is looking basically for happiness and for a home. And really,
he's a mouse.
What he's looking for is this bird friend of his named Margalo, who's not dissimilar from Candide, sort of chasing around his love, Cunegonde. So Stuart Little has all these crazy adventures, and he gets this little car, and he's traveling all over upstate New York. And at the end, I will spoil it. He's in a little car, and he's not sure where he's going, but he knew he was headed in the right direction. And that's like so sweet. And it's like, I mean, to be honest, it's interspecies love. It's like a mouse loves a bird. Like, that's kind of cool.
Okay, there is a newer children's book that I have to mention. Has anyone here read Ocean Meets Sky?
Yes.
God, it's beautiful.
Yes, it is. The illustrations are absolutely stunning. And it's by the Tan Brothers?
Mm-hmm. The Fan Brothers.
Fan Brothers. The illustrations are stunning. And it's a lovely story about grief and a grandson's relationship with his grandfather and how your memories can help you get through your grief.
Yeah, he goes on the journey they had planned together, but in a dream. And I won't say anymore. It's the visual journey that you go on in a sort of fantasy world is pretty amazing.
Is it like a picture book?
Mm-hmm. It is. It's a picture book. It's in regular rotation now for any brand new mom in my life.
What are their fan?
The Fan Brothers.
The Fan Brothers. Yeah. What age group?
I've been reading it to my kid since he was two, but I think it could apply much older. It's just how much you as a parent would choose to share about what the meaning is, because it never mentions that the grandfather has died. You don't have to even say mm-hmm. that. Anyway, that's Ocean Meets Sky. Before we go, an actual, like, if you're going on a trip, Katie, you are recommending the Eyewitness Travel Guides. Let's remember some people might actually be going on a trip.
Yes, and if you're really going on a trip, I love the Dorling Kindersley Eyewitness Travel Guides. I read them for fun. If you're going on a trip and you take one of these books, please buy two because you need to rip out the pages as you go along. And yes, I'm a librarian. I'm saying that. These are heavy books because they are so well produced and they are gorgeous. So I did buy two copies of this one.
You could use a copy machine.
You could, but I would just rip out the pages I needed and then throw them away as I was
going. Better than Lonely Planet.
I think so. Far better than Lonely Planet or For Doors. And Dorling Kindersley does gorgeous travel books, and it's the cross cuts, it's the illustrations, it's the architecture, it's the drawings. You can navigate a street using a Dorling Kindersley guide.
All right, that's the Dorling Kindersley Eyewitness Travel Guides. Bibliophiles, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Katie Stover is with us from the Kansas City Public Library. Mark Luce teaches at Barstow School and KU, and Jeffrey Angowdy is a freelance journalist and book critic for many publications. Our time is up, but this has been a much-needed getaway, and the Kansas City Library is always generously making lists that take you right to our books that we've recommended in their catalog. So check that out. KCUR.org/Central Standard. We'll link to it with the audio later today. Central Standard is produced by Melody Rowell, Mackenzie Martin, and Noah Taborda, with help today from Michelle Tyrene Johnson. Sylvia Maria Gross is our senior producer. I'm Gina Kaufman. Stick around for Up to Date.